The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
All right. Hi, everyone. We're here to talk about the use of assistive technologies in spinal deformities. Specifically, we're going to talk about robotics as well as spinal navigation. I am Zeeshan Sardar. I'm one of the spine surgeons at Columbia in New York. I use robotic technology quite frequently. And with me, we have the pleasure of talking to Dr. David Pauly, who is going to say a few words about himself, and then we'll start talking about the actual topic itself.
Hi, I'm Dr. David Pauly, and I am the Chief of Spine Surgery at the University of Minnesota. And along with Zeeshan, we are both members of the Spinal Deformity Committee within NASS.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Pauly. So, you know, the reason for this podcast or session was essentially to go over some of the benefits or as well as disadvantages of the assistive technology that we use nowadays in spinal deformity, and then to try to have a bit of a comparison between the two. So I will, and you know, feel free to ask me things as well, but I'll start off with giving a bit of what I do. I use the robotic technology quite routinely, essentially in all my deformity cases, especially in adult cases, where I'm fusing to the pelvis. And my typical flow is that I'll use one registration to try to get screws in from the lower lumbar spine down to the pelvis, and the rest I do freehand. And so before we go into pros and cons and other things, how is your typical flow like for these cases in terms of using these technologies?
Yeah, great question, Zeeshan. And I started using intraoperative cone beam CT and navigation in about 2007. So we all have had extensive experience in my generation and your generation in freehand pedicle screw placement. And the question was, do we need it? Well, I think for, you know, a 7 millimeter, 8 millimeter, 9 millimeter, 10 millimeter lumbar pedicle, yeah, you can hit that across the room, one hand tied behind your back, no problem. But as you get more deformity and rotation and altered anatomy, it gets more challenging. The next component is that sometimes we have dural ectasia, neurofibromatosis, Marfan's, where the pedicles are really small, or even just L1, which can be 3 millimeters sometimes. So the ability to get larger and longer screws with high reliability allows us then to apply greater corrective force on the screws. So you can do it a number of ways, but being able to reliably obtain optimized screw purchase then allows you to get greater deformity correction in my experience.
So for the cases that you do, is there part of the spine that you rely more on for navigation, or is it the whole spine? Like, how do you decide?
Great question. And so we made the decision when we started doing navigation that we were going to use it on all of our cases, whether we needed it or not. And the thought was that if we used it in cases where it wasn't particularly hard, that our team would get good at using it for cases where it was hard. So in general, we use it for all levels and all screws. And so we've adopted the Ronald Reaganism of trust but verify. So we place our screws and then we do check spins to ensure that they're accurately placed. And we did a prospective study of a little more than 1,000 pedicle screws. And what we found is, again, our return to OR rate since 2007 for screw malposition has been zero. Our intraoperative screw change rate is between 1 and 3%. So the navigation is very good. It's enhanced a lot of things, but we also acknowledge that sometimes we have a screw that we don't want to be where it is, and that I like the concept of not leaving the OR with anything potentially in a bad place. So I'd much rather take an intraoperative check spin and then say, oh, it'll take me 3 minutes to change and correct this screw versus, Oh, we're in the post-op and recovery. The L5 nerve root doesn't seem happy. Ooh, let's go to CT. Ooh, is it bad enough to take the patient back to the OR? And so we've chosen to perform our workflow that way. And I've been happy with the results. Little more radiation exposure to the patient, but again, the return to OR rate has been zero since 2007 for
Yeah,
screw malposition. We don't return to the OR for all the other usual reasons, but yes.
I wish we get to zero in all of them. But you know, I totally agree. Yeah, I kind of have the same flow, you know, in terms of honestly, even for our one or two levels, even like non-deformity cases, once the screws are in, I just use the CT as my final check to make sure that we just never have to come back for a screw issue. And that's been from a screw malpositioning perspective. In the same, we haven't had to come back for a screw malposition because you just check it and drop, and then that part is done. But for the rest, totally agree. You know, again, same thing for us. When I started doing robotics, I pretty much use it for all my cases, not for all levels, but essentially for all adult cases. I'll use the robot for the same that, number one, it just kind of becomes a workflow, and second, and the team is used to it. Just like you said, I think the efficiency improves with the number of uses as well. How about pediatric cases? Are you using navigation for those as well? Are you less prone to use it because of radiation or other things, or are the same?
Yeah, so the cases where I don't use it, when I'm doing a congenital in 1 or 2 year olds, sometimes the spinous process isn't robust enough to hold the reference frame. And so then I'll go back to freehand and fluoro as a strategy. That's not very often, but otherwise I do use it in the pediatric cases. We do try to dose adjust to minimize radiation exposure, but I want to get it right, and I think in my mind, the trade-off to avoid potential neurologic problems is worth it. Others may have differing opinions, but that's okay. I do want to comment a little bit about workflow because I visited you and had a chance to see how you all work at Ox, and what we did at Minnesota when we started using this technology was we practiced by bringing the O-arm into the room and closing it around to the patient and making sure we could move it up and down. And that it was a big deal for the first, I don't know, 3 to 6 months. And after that, the OR team would say, "You want the C-arm or the O-arm?" And it was like no big deal, no difference to them. And that everybody says, "Well, it slows me down." Well, as we got our workflow down, and it's really a workflow issue. I mean, so much of spine surgery efficiency is workflow. And so it's your team and what they expect from you, what they know, and how you accomplish it. And so that we timed how long it takes us to put screws in with navigation. And it's about 2, 2.5 minutes. And yeah, there's some people who can put screws in faster than that, more power to them. I'm not sure I want to put screws in much faster than that. And so that's been our workflow. We do have to acquire, so if we're doing T2 to the pelvis, that may be 3 spins in order to do the navigation. But we bring the O-arm in and then park it at the head out of the way. And so we bring it in, drape it, and then do our workflow. And then we actually use it to take our intraoperative long films as well, because we don't have other capabilities for long films. So that's how our workflow works. And that's been very efficient for us for a decade and a half.
So the arm stays in the whole time.
Yes.
Once you get it in, it stays in. It just kind of on one end or the other.
Yes.
Okay, got it. Got it. And how did you guys decide using the arm? I guess at that point, probably there wasn't a robot if you started this in 2007. But if you were to, I guess, look at it again, would you still go with the arm? Would you look at the robotic technology a bit more?
Yeah, so it was an interesting experience for me when we got a robot, and that I did the training, and I did a case with one of my colleagues, and that the challenge for me is that we had gotten so efficient with navigation that I wasn't prepared to go through the robotic learning curve. It's sort of like, okay. And I also do recognize that a robot does bring some advantages, and specifically the work that you put in on the front end of planning, and that the work that Greg Poulter and Roland Kent have done in their elegant work for doing big deformities, doing anterior inner body work, and then posterior perk screws, where they perfectly position the screws so that the screw reduction to the rod does the deformity correction, I do think is better than what I do with my conventional open posterior work. And so I do see that a robot has some advantages. I just have not chosen to take on the learning curve at this point. And so, Zixin, I'd be curious about your comments about, I know one of your partners does not use the robot, and that I'm sure you guys have some interesting discussions about that and about workflow.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think the biggest advantage for me for using the robot, other than the accuracy, is really the pre-op planning part, as you were kind of suggesting. And I think even in the pre-op planning part, I think it's really in the mo in the kind of mid to lower lumbar spine, sacrum, iliac, that lower region, where I think it makes the biggest difference, because that's where we're trying to get, the accurate amount of lordosis and correction and everything. We're really focusing in everything from in the L2 to S1, but really even more so from L4 to the pelvis to really get those right. And I think, for me, getting that placement, perfect, and then using that placement to plan my rods that I'm going to use for reduction, to me, that I think that's a huge advantage of using this, because I have everything planned. What we figured out as we were initially using the robot, and obviously you can place the screw and it looks good, and then we were using the pre-planned rods, but what we realized is that it's really the actual, like to the millimeter, the depth of the screw insertion makes such a big difference in terms of the correction that you get even with those pre-planned rods. And so I think the key advantage here, the way I use it, is that I'll plan all my screws, and I'll actually send that screw plan to the people who make the rod, so that they know exactly what depth the tulip of my screw is going to sit, and that's what it can then be used to plan the rod to get the correction that I need to get. And I think that's been really, because initially when we were not doing that, you would still have to make some adjustments intra-op, either move the position of the screw, or you're still bending the rod a little bit more, to try to get things in properly. And I think you may lose the actual amount of correction that you're getting. But now that we can plan everything beforehand to the actual millimeter, and then send it for the rod planning as well, and then get that back, I think that's really kind of taking it to the next step and really helping me. I think, in terms of, like you said, in terms of accuracy of the placement, I think both technologies are quite equivalent. I think both are really useful, obviously in deformity, but also in revision cases where you have a huge, just fusion mass, especially like cases with Harrington rods and things like that. And I think it's even for those cases, it's been very useful for me, because now what I do is I just pre-plan all my screws. I try to plan things around the rod as much as possible, so that I don't have to take the rod out. If the rod is not in the way of my osteotomies, I try not to take the rod out, Harrington rod. So I try to plan everything, and the screws may look a bit funny because they're going in all different directions. But it's just so useful then to just plan everything around the prior rods, and not having to cut things out and take things out and just, go with that. And I think the same thing with navigation. You can plan things or insert screws without having to do a lot of bone work. Before I started using the robot, I was definitely using more, kind of taking in those 3D models, or even having to do more bone work to try to identify some anatomy, to be able to then put in like the screws in the position that I want. And I do think that using some of these technologies, it allows us to remove less bone, because we can rely a little bit more on the navigation or robotics. And I think that's a key difference that I've made in terms of, how much bone work I have to do just for pedicle screw insertion. Obviously, you have to do what you have to do to make the spine flexible to do the deformity correction. But I feel like I do less removal of bone just for insertion of the screws to find the landmarks. I think that's been another, what's your take on that?
So I want to reflect on a couple of things that you said. So we've gone to doing stacked SAI pelvic fixation, and I'm a fan of quad rods to the pelvis, and that can be done with fluoro. I'm not sure that I know anybody who can do it stacked pelvic fixation without fluoro. Maybe somebody can, more power to them. But that allows us to reliably get it in. And you start to learn a lot more about pelvic anatomy and the prevalence of dysmorphic sacrum, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think in the pelvis, it is particularly powerful. And then the next piece that I think gets underappreciated is the concept of cognitive burden in the OR, and that we have a lot of things that we have to manage. We have to manage a lot of things preoperatively to establishing our plan. What are our goals? I use patient-specific rods as well. So we've got that plan, pre-plan, and then we've got to get the exposure done. And if it's a big deformity or revision work, that exposure is straining to the surgeon. Then you've got to put the screws in. And when we first started doing thoracic pedicle screws, that was a really big deal and a high cognitive burden. Now putting the screws in is usually like the easiest part of the day, right? And so you can put the screws in without substantial cognitive burden so that you are more prepared as a surgeon to go on and do your osteotomies and get your deformity correction. And I like what you said about what the robot pre-planning allows you to do in terms of lining up the screws. And we've sort of had to figure that out on our own, sort of looking top to bottom. What are our start points? How do we get them lined up? And for sagittal plane deformities, I think that's pretty straightforward. In the coronal plane deformities, I still struggle with that because the patient-specific rods give you a great sagittal contour, but it still doesn't really facilitate the spine to rod translation. You got to use reduction towers or reduction screws or some sort of adjunctive thing to make that work. And so we're still improving on our ability to do that. And again, what I've seen you all do and others do with the navigation systems and getting the exact height of the screw heads is an advantage that I sort of do by Kentucky windage, but you all are doing more precisely. And so kudos to you all for that.
What do you think? What do you see as a big, I guess, compared to the, and I'll talk about the robot as well, but compared to the robot, like a big negative of navigation? I mean, obviously you're talking about benefits, and I think both technologies have a lot. But if you were to think about it, what's a con of the nav? And I'll talk about some for the robot as well.
Right. So if you're going to use this technology, you have to understand it. Okay. So there is an upfront capital cost to your institution to make it work. And for us, it's one more person in the OR running the O-arm and running the navigation screen to make that work. With the investment in developing a team, that goes pretty efficiently, but it is an acknowledgeable cost. The trade-off is that, in my experiences, it's decreased the OR time, and so you get it done faster. Now, the downside is that you can't blindly trust the technology that you can mess it up, and you need to understand how you can mess it up. And when we're doing open surgery, it's relatively easy for us with navigation to take a tracking probe and point to a known anatomic landmark, midline spinous process. Are we on track or not? And if we're not, you say, is it enough that I can do what I need to do, or do I need to reacquire or re-register? And so that, I think, is really incumbent upon the surgeon not to have blind faith in what's being shown on the screen as being the real truth, unless you can find a way to validate and verify that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's actually very similar to with the robot as well. I mean, I always tell my residents and fellows and everyone that the robot is a gentle giant. You can't put any force on it because it's just going to show you what it thinks. But as you manipulate the spine or the patient real, it may not be the reality is, what we're looking at. So I completely agree. I think especially with open cases in with freehand, we're used to kind of forcing our angles against the skin and getting what we need to get, but with the robot, we can't do that. It's basically a tension-free screw insertion, and all of the focus kind of centers around making that insertion tension-free, because whatever there is tissue tension or some kind of manipulation, that's where we end up in trouble. So I think that would be not necessarily a negative, but more of the, you know, that's where you have to be. We have to be the most careful when I use a robot. I think all technologies are a little bit different. You know, to me, the reason I typically will do one registration and do the rest freehand, as I kind of suggested, because and maybe we just haven't gotten the flow as well yet. But there is a bit of an overhead with each registration of the robot, because you know, I use pre-op CT to fluoro conversion. So we have our screws planned on the pre-op CT, and then intra-op, we have to again register everything with an AP as well as an oblique lateral C-arm shot, basically, to then map it to the pre-op CT. And it does take a little, it's not a lot of time, but it does add, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes or so per registration. And so to me, the most value really has been more in the lower part, especially pelvic screws, like you said, especially if you're putting in multiple pelvic screws. And I don't think I can say it about any other, you know, like with freehand or even with X-ray, but so far we have not had a malplaced pelvic screw with a robot. And I'm sure with the navigation as well, it's probably very similar, but it's just, you know, for pelvic fixation, these technologies are just so good. And you get these, you know, great robust pelvic screws in one shot. Otherwise, with freehand, we're, you know, we can get it, but you do have to try a few times sometimes. So for me, the flow really has been that, you know, we'll kind of get the bottom part done, L3 or L2 to the pelvis, and I guess after that, once you kind of get into the deep, get out of the deep hole, and more into the thoracic spine, then I'll usually do freehand more to save time. Because each registration does add a little bit more time to it, but it also depends on who's on the other side, and also depends on the anatomy of the patient. You know, patients who have relatively straightforward anatomy, it's easy. Patients who have a bit of a difficult anatomy, especially hands and rods, I will definitely, you know, do the second registration and go up to because there's no landmark, as opposed to then using other things. So I think that's where, so that's a little bit different. In terms of how I use it, but you know, again, most people who use it, I think, still will use everything kind of going up as well, and it's pretty accurate with that as well.
So, Zishan, as we're closing out this evening, if someone were to take your robot away, would you be offended or not offended by that?
I think I'd be a little bit upset, but I would still be able to work. And you know, again, there have been times where, for one reason or another, we are not able to use it. But I think, you know, again, the key is that all these technologies help, but you still need to have a backup, right? So, I mean, I think we are lucky. We do have a few backups in terms of assistive technology. And then I think if all else fails, you still have the freehand techniques, and we can still find our landmarks. And like I said, you know, if I'm doing a freehand in someone with distorted landmarks, that may mean that I have to do a little bit more bone work to find the anatomy that I'm more familiar with before I put screws in. But then that's the work that I have to put in.
Yeah, I think that speaks for both of us, what we think about the technology, that we would prefer to use it every time that we want to use it.
Yeah.
So can we do things other ways? Yes. Do we want to do them that way? Nah. And it's sort of like, I suspect sometimes even when you drive home now, that you might use navigation technologies to drive home, but you probably still know the way. So.
Yeah, that's so true. I turn the nav on to make sure that if there's a traffic block or something, I don't have to sit there for 5 hours.
Yes.
So I can find a different way around. So, you know, absolutely right. I think it's the same. You have a way to get home, but this just gives you sometimes a better way.
An optimal way to get home.
Optimal way. But I think just to conclude, I guess what we are seeing is that assistive technology definitely has a role. I think it does make you know, a placement of screws a bit more safe. I think the use of then confirmation intra-op helps. I think both of us sounds like haven't had to take patients back at least recently for screw malplacement. And I think, you know, again, workflow helps. If you, the more you use it, the more you and the team gets better at it. And for some, I think it also helps a lot with pre-planning and everything. Anything else you would like to add, Dr. Pauly, in summary?
Great. Thanks for taking the time. I hope that the audience finds this useful and look forward to seeing folks at the meetings going forward.
Well, great. Thank you very much. I hope you have a good evening.